guys, and welcome to episode 168 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interview therapist Karina Dash. She's licensed in states Colorado and Florida. And in this episode, we talk about her therapy story, how she applies exposure therapy in her own life, advice for someone starting ERP, staying consistent with exposure therapy after treatment, dealing with difficult emotions, acknowledging your progress, living with uncertainty, creative exposure exercises, and I ask her, what is parent training? So we talk about support groups, being in nature, and much, much more. So I think you're going to enjoy this episode. Karina's lovely, and I had a good conversation with her, so hope you find it useful. So without further ado, here is Karina.
On the podcast today, I have Karina Dash. Karina is a licensed therapist in Colorado and Florida. I had the privilege of meeting her at the OCD Game Changers event in Denver recently, and welcome to the show, Karina.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to get you on. And as I always start with therapists is, well, A, if you have an OCD story or a mental health story, feel free to share that if you want. If not, it'd be good to just know your therapy story, how you got into it and why you ended up working with people with OCD.
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I had a more exciting answer. As a graduate student, I did my internship at a hospital, and that was when I was introduced to OCD. And the more I learned about the condition and how it presented, the more interested I became, and the more I learned about the treatment model and exposure and response prevention, the more it made sense to me. And I really truly believed that it's an effective model, and I felt confident being able to help those suffering. And so that's basically how I got on this track of specializing in OCD.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing. And, you know, I've heard that many times. It's therapists suddenly come across OCD and the treatment model, and they're just blown away by the effectiveness and also the people with OCD. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's extremely interesting. I use the model in my everyday life, and I've never been diagnosed with OCD. So I just believe in it. I believe in the lifestyle and the philosophy of thinking, you know, and that approach really pushing you forward and helping you achieve whatever it is you want to achieve.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And is that just something that's become kind of habitual for you in the sense of, I don't know, you're trying to think of an example. You're out somewhere and I don't know, you need to face some kind of fear. So maybe you're a bit anxious about talking to someone, or, and do you consciously kind of go for that in your head, or do you think it's just become automatic where you'll just push through that and do it anyway?
I am constantly thinking about situations and how to apply the concept of exposure and how to stop myself from responding in the way that feels the most safest. So the most recent example I can give you, was last season I started skiing. I moved to Colorado about 2.5 years ago. My husband is what I call a professional skier. He laughs at me because he's not compared to the pros, but to me, he is the best skier I know. I don't know. Do you know much about skiing?
More snowboarding than skiing.
Okay. Well, snowboarding is a good example too, but I used to snowboard until I realized that it was probably going to be my demise. I would just like mouse trap, you know, and my board would just hit the back of my head and scorpion. It was bad. So I switched to skis. And the concept of skiing is you really have to go against your natural instinct, and you have to lean into the mountain and kind of push forward down a steep slope. And I felt that was so interesting because it represented ERP so well. I mean, in the sense of leaning into the distress, leaning into the uncertainty, because you don't know if you're going to fall. You don't know if you're going to be able, if your body's going to be able to manage to get down well. And so I think being able to apply that concept to that scenario was really effective. So, you know, I went for it, not knowing whether it was going to be a success. There were times where I fell, getting back up, figuring out how to get back down again. In other situations, like for more personal life situations, the exposure model has been helpful for me as well. You know, tragedy within families, uncertainty regarding health, you know, even this conversation right now is nerve-wracking, but it's really invigorating knowing that, you know, whatever happens, I'll be able to get through it, find a way to push.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, no, thank you for that. That was really interesting. And these episodes, recording these podcasts, even, I think I'm on what this would be like 170 or something. I don't know what number it would be, but I would comfortably say it took me to about episode 120 before I stopped feeling nervous before doing it.
Wow.
And only rarely now will I get nervous, but so it took a long time.
Good for you for making it to 120.
Oh, thank you. But that's where like the value stuff comes in of actually I want to do it. And once I get past that initial anxiety, it's good fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because you're spreading a really important message.
Thank you.
So that the value got me here too. Maybe I need 100 more interviews before I start feeling more comfortable.
And maybe I'll get you on 99 more times.
There you go.
Cool. So a general ERP question then that I like to ask some therapists, which is just, and obviously, you know, this would be when you're with someone in a room, you'd be explaining the whole model of ERP and you know, the ways best to do it and the pitfalls to avoid. But just kind of what would you say to someone starting ERP? Let's say they have a therapist. And it's just general kind of encouragement for that.
So an example that I use for ERP is it's kind of like working out in a gym.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Have you heard this example before?
I don't think so. No.
So everybody, you know, goes to the gym at one point or another. Somebody who's really interested in getting, you know, strength building or losing weight, they might take more of an interest. And so they go to the gym and they're working out really hard, but they're not really getting the effects they're looking for, and they're feeling frustrated or they're feeling insecure about the way they look. And so somebody who would hire a personal trainer would be somebody who's looking for a therapist to help them learn how to kind of do that activity in a more effective way. And so that's kind of how I explain. I'm this coach, right? I'm a coach in a sense that I teach you how to use the machines well and in an effective way. I challenge the way you use those machines. I try and help you modify those exercises in a way that makes sense, feels a little uncomfortable, so you feel a burn. But that's when you start experiencing results and start, you know, having outcomes that you are really proud of. And then over time, as you become more comfortable, you know, challenging your exercises, trying them in different ways, you and I stop meeting as frequently because you've developed the skills to be able to face the situations that feel really nerve-wracking and uncomfortable. You are able to stop avoiding situations that feel distressing, and you're kind of finding new and creative ways of getting those results that you're looking for.
Yeah. No, I love that. I haven't heard it. And it leads me perfectly into my next question, which is how do you encourage continued ERP after therapy? Because obviously when people leave, they're not seeing you each week. They're not with their therapist. They're not, you know, being held accountable effectively to do those exposures, that homework or whatever it is. But as you said, that you've now given them the skills, you've worked with them on that. How do you kind of help them keep at it, I guess?
It's a great question. And so what we find, or what I find when I speak to my colleagues, is this stagnation, is this like good enough feeling where a client, you know, they feel like I've worked really hard and I've gotten to this point and I just want to take a break. I want to kind of coast and just enjoy the hard work. And so I use the gym exercise in session. And I say, if you stop going back to the gym and you start eating the way you were before, it's likely that you'll gain the weight that you worked hard to lose. So it's really important that even if you don't want to work out as hard as you were with the trainer, that you still show up to the gym.
Yeah.
If you want to walk for 15 minutes on the treadmill, But it's really important that every day you just try and find one opportunity where you feel your heart beating a little bit faster. You give yourself an opportunity to exercise a little bit. But it's a challenge. It's definitely very, very difficult. And one way I support clients who are kind of phasing out of intense, you know, weekly sessions is I tell them they're in maintenance stage. So, you know, we'll do a check-in maybe once every couple of months to kind of give them that accountability.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, no, I like that. That's good. again, the gym analogy fits perfectly with it. Okay, cool. So as people start to reduce compulsions, be that in the head or, you know, in the real world, so to speak, like washing hands, checking, etc., they get more time back, especially if the compulsions are taking up hours of a day. And from what I've gathered, some people find it hard to deal with sort of the guilt and shame around the lost time and the lost opportunities. And mm-hmm. I guess what would you say to someone kind of experiencing that?
It's a very common thing to experience. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of anger too. OCD took away these really important years of my life. OCD compromised a very important relationship that I had. And the shame work is really important in the work that you do with an OCD therapist. You know, it's a hard question to answer because for everybody it's a little bit different, but what I would recommend is giving yourself, you know, the space to acknowledge how much you've accomplished and how hard of a journey it was, and that everyone is, you know, handed different challenges in life, but to feel self-compassionate and understand this was a journey that you went through. You know, I had a professor who told me never to equalize suffering. So for you, you know, this suffering could be just as equal as somebody who, you know, was orphaned or somebody who experienced a traumatic trauma in their life. Mm-hmm. So to just be kind to yourself and, you know, give yourself permission to feel the loss and, you know, to feel the loss and to grieve the loss and to give yourself some space to still be kind to the person that you are right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that. And next question is around living with uncertainty. So very vague question, but just advice or words about living with uncertainty.
Well, that's life, right?
Yeah.
I always ask my clients in the office, what is a certain thing that you can come up with? It's usually death. Hmm. Some people say taxes, but hey, people sometimes don't pay their taxes. but there really isn't very much certainty in life ever. And there's a, you know, I encourage a radical level of acceptance with that concept of understanding that, you know, wanting to know is kind of like grabbing a handful of sand. Like the more sand you grab, you know, the quicker it falls between your fingers and you're chasing something that, it really doesn't exist. So, you know, it's a very hard place to be, but it's uncomfortable not knowing what the future holds, because I don't know about the UK, but in Western, in the education system, we're taught at a very early age to plan your future, you know, the 5-year plan, you know, get good grades so that you can get into a good college, so that you can get in, you know, a good job, so you can have a happy life and feel successful. And then you get to the end of that line and you're wondering, well, what next?
Yeah.
And so I think it's really about shifting the paradigm of thinking. It's less about wanting to predict what the future holds and more about feeling excited by the wonderment of not knowing and allowing yourself to realize that there are more opportunities. You know, imagine you were in this room with, you know, an endless number of doors. You could pick any which one of them. And, you know, one door would lead you one way, the other door would lead you the other. That's you know, more opportunistic. That creates more chance of growth, more opportunity to learn something new about yourself, learn something new about the world. But if you were just given one door you had to walk through time and time again, that might feel more safe, but it's very empty.
Boring.
Very boring. Yes. Yeah. Very boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not much that you can look forward to if you know exactly what's going to be.
That's a good point. And sometimes that uncertainty does create pain, but
yes,
also it creates joy. And it's like, as you said, life, it's taking both together and living mm-hmm. anyway.
Right.
Yeah, we were told the same thing in the UK, kind of get good grades, yeah. whether that's to get a good degree or whether to get a good job, blah, 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 blah.
Follow the path to happiness and certainty.
Exactly.
Even though there is no path, right? You know, happiness is the same way. The more you try and find it and chase it, and everything that you're doing is, you know, geared towards happiness, the further away you become. You know, so happiness is a byproduct of your choices. It's not the end goal.
No, absolutely. That's why I love the title of that book, The Happiness Trap.
Right. That's a good title.
It is a trap. For me, it's a byproduct emotion you get from doing things you want to do or enjoy, and then happiness comes as a result.
Yes.
As opposed to that is the goal in of itself.
Yes.
Cool. But no one listened to me. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, as long as you're practicing that concept within your life, then, you know, that's all that you can do.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you said, walk your own path. And I'm constantly figuring out mine, but enjoying the journey. So, cool. So one thing I saw on your website that I really liked, which was you said that you tailor your clinical approach to each individual client. What are a couple examples where you got creative with clients?
A couple examples where we got creative. It's a great question. I wish you gave me time to prepare. So now I'm pulling from my past experiences. It really depends on the presenting symptom, but, you know, a lot of the in vivo exposures are definitely tailored to each individual client. I'd say one in vivo exposure I did was kind of encouraging the client to walk into every store that we pass by and to wish the person at the front desk a good day and tell them that you're really happy to see them. For that client, it was absurd and extremely anxiety provoking because they were, you know, triggered by these intrusive thoughts that nobody wants to hear them say that and that they're interrupting someone's day and it's a rude thing to do and that, it ties into worth and, you know, compassion. I have such good stories, and now my mind is drawing a big blank.
That person should go work for Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, Chick-fil-A.
Those people are super nice.
Are they very? Do they have Chick-fil-A in?
No, we don't. No?
So that's like the first stop you make when you come to the U.S. Yeah. Chick-fil-A, please.
I always feel better about myself when I go in there.
Because they're so kind and so nice.
It's ridiculous.
So nice. So, yeah, it depends. I mean, some of these exposures are very creative, you know, some of them. See, I worked with a kiddo who was afraid of the devil. And so, you know, we cut up paper and made a collage welcoming the devil into the house and having a party. And, you know, a lot of the scrupulosity, you know, there's taboo around saying, you know, God's name in vain. So there's a lot of exposures around that. I'm trying to think if you gave me like, hey, you know, what kind of exposure would you do for a person presenting with harm OCD, or what have you done? Then it might be easier for me to pull from my memory.
Cool. No, that's right. Those are two really good examples. I like to put people on the spot because then you get very real and authentic answers. Yeah.
My reel is blank. Oh, man.
No, that was good. I like that. Cool. So this is a bit of a random question, but I like to ask it in case there's a, you know, a unique answer, which is, has your view of treatment of OCD changed over the last few, 3 years?
Yes, that's a great question. I thought you might ask, so I thought about that one.
Cool.
Yes, my view definitely has changed. And I think it comes with experience. When I first started off, you know, as this novice therapist, I really wanted to follow protocol. It was very scientific. And I think as I learned about the process and, you know, the difficulties and challenges, and I developed, you know, my skill set, I, you know, it became more about, having compassion, developing acceptance, really seeing the person for, you know, in the situation they're in right now, and taking treatment at their pace rather than following a checklist.
Yeah.
And, you know, allowing them to drive. I tell them, you know, I'm the GPS system. I just make suggestions, turn here, turn there. Traffic is heavy down here. Maybe take a detour.
Yeah.
And they decide whether they want to make those turns or whether they want to follow the path I'm recommending, or they want to follow the path that is familiar to them. And I think with experience, I've become really accepting of that. And I appreciate that rather than feeling frustrated that they're resistant or they're not working as hard as I am. It becomes more about their journey and me, you know, being honored that I get to join them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good to hear. Yeah, and that goes back to the question before of like how you tailor your clinical approach to each individual client.
Yes.
Yeah, as opposed to...
Some people have a darker sense of humor, so it's easier for me to kind of be a little bit more direct,
yeah,
to kind of go right to the core of what they're afraid of, and they're more, you know, they're more willing to embrace and accept that. Some clients are not there yet, and they want to take it really slow, and they're uncomfortable in session. They are willing to open up just enough for me to develop some type of relationship, but you know, they're still very reserved and guarded, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Some clients just want to go for it, and you know, I go for it with them.
It's kind of like the game Cards Against Humanity.
Yes,
play that.
exactly right. You can choose how raw you want to be. You could choose, yeah, you know, how willing you are to go to that dark place of your mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. So another thing I spotted on your site that I don't think I've ever asked anyone, which is you talk about parent training. So in the case of OCD, what is parent training?
Another really good question. So parent training is a lot of psychoeducation, being able to help a parent understand that, one, they didn't do anything wrong, and two, that although they feel they're helping their child, they might be doing something that's hindering their ability to grow. And I explained that ERP goes against every maternal, paternal instinct. You know, I think we have this evolutionary need to protect and nurture our young.
Yeah.
And we want to make them feel good all the time. You know, we work really hard to give them, you know, to give them opportunities, and we work really hard to provide them a life that we might not have had for ourselves. And, you know, if they cry, we want to console them. And if they hurt themselves, we want to make it all better. And I think, you know, if your kid has OCD, that approach, although very kind, is not very effective. It's really enabling.
Mm.
And so it's really about teaching the parent how to coach their kid, how to coach their child or their adult child, and teach them how to support them in an effective way, so that instead of holding them back and keeping them stuck, you know, they kind of allow them to spread their wings. And I always use, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, which I'm drawing a blank. Jamie Foxx plays he's a pianist. Do you know what movie I'm talking about?
I do, yeah. Is it?
Let me see.
Ray?
What is it?
Ray?
Ray Charles.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, you're right. Ray Charles. In that movie, he's blind. Hmm. There's a clip in the beginning of the film. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's worth seeing this clip because I play it for parents sometimes. And there's a clip he has these flashbacks throughout the film. And one of the flashbacks is when he's a child. And he's in his home with his mother, and his mother's in the kitchen, and he's in the living room, and he's walking, and he stubs his toe, and he falls down to the ground, and he yells, "Mama, Mama," and he's crying, "Mama, I need you." And his mother drops whatever she was doing and turns to him, but quickly stops, because she knows that if she keeps picking him up, he'll never learn how to do it for himself. Hmm. And you can see tears streaming down her face because she's watching him suffer. She's watching him struggle. But what happens is he pays attention to what he hears. He hears a cricket, you know, and he like reaches for it. He catches it and he holds it in his hand and he slowly walks to his mother and he says, "I see you, Mama." And she falls to the floor in tears, so proud of him for being able to work through that on his own. And I think every child needs the opportunity to do that. And when you have OCD, you need even more of an opportunity to work through that without the reassurance, without the accommodation.
Yeah. Cool. No, thank you for that explanation. And I can absolutely see why it's useful. And I've had many parents contact me and rightly so, sometimes they don't know how to act or what to do or what to say. So I can absolutely see how that would be very useful.
And yeah, and they're great books. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, and the bit you said about telling them it's not their fault.
Yeah, it's not their fault. I've had parents come in and say, like, what did I do? I've done something wrong. It's not your fault if your kid gets diabetes or if your kid develops cancer, if your kid breaks their leg on the playground. You know, this is just circumstances that you work through. So, yeah, helping a parent realize that they didn't do anything wrong is definitely very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you said you mentioned good books there. There's the John Hirschfield one. When a family member has
OCD. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a great one.
Yeah, I did an episode with him as well. Anyone interested, buy that exact title. So you can just Google that. Cool. All right. So, and I also see that you run an adult OCD support group in Colorado. Is it once a month?
So we meet twice a month, first and third Tuesday of the month. Cool. And the group is really there as a support network for those suffering because, you know, as I'm sure you've heard, as I'm sure you know, a lot of people who are struggling with symptoms feel very alone and isolated. And so we just wanted to create a community that they could access, that they felt that they could supplement their own individual therapy for extra support. It's a more affordable way of getting help, of learning about exposure, about challenging their fears. And it's really such a cool experience, you know, seeing relationships build within that space and, you know, encouraging everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And next question is about, and I'm sure this is extremely common, and someone fairly close to me was struggling with anxiety a little while ago before they sought help, and they found a support group in London for anxiety, and then they didn't end up going because of anxiety.
Was it your group?
No, it wasn't my group. No. Someone in my sort of immediate friends and family circle was struggling with anxiety, and they found a support group, and then a couple of times they just kept bailing on going. Because anxiety itself is like, what happens if I don't get on with anyone? What happens if people judge me? X, Y, and Z, million right. thoughts. So anyone, whether they have OCD or anxiety, listening, I guess any words of comfort and insight to really push them over that line and get their ass through the door, so to speak.
Yeah, just drive and park. That's it.
Yeah.
You don't have to go inside. You know, you don't have to take it any further, but just get in your car and drive to the address and kind of assess what's going on at that point. You know, I like breaking down situations into smaller, more, you know, more attainable goals. And when you kind of reach for the end, like, I'm going to go to this group and I'm going to share and I'm going to really stretch my comforts, it feels overwhelming. The anticipatory anxiety becomes, you know, it's incapacitating. And so if you just, I would recommend just boiling it down into small steps, you know, type the address into your phone, figure out how long it's going to take you, drive there before the group, kind of scout it out, see, you know, what it was like getting there. I'd also recommend calling the facilitators. You know, if the group is run by someone, it's really helpful giving them a call, just introducing yourself, learning a little bit more about the group. You know, because if you're stuck in your mind, it's always the most catastrophic outcome.
Yeah.
But if you allow yourself to be present and to, you know, take action that's value-based to help you reach that goal and you kind of slow it down, you know, those fears kind of diminish and it's, oh, well, she or he sounded really nice on the phone. Or he or that place isn't that far away, or, oh, I know that place. I've been there before. I didn't realize they had a group there. And it just becomes a little bit more normalized and less scary.
Absolutely. I love the breaking it down part. And it's like, now, oh, I'm in the car park. I might as well just go in.
Maybe not that group. You get there and you realize, I'll try next time.
Yeah. Good point.
Just going. Yeah, 70% of it is just showing up.
Absolutely. Cool. So one thing I noticed on your business Facebook page is you have a lot of pictures of sort of wilderness and mountains. And you've put some kind of messages to those. But it'd be good to know, why mountains, why wilderness? How does it relate to mental health for you, I guess?
Yeah. How does it relate to mental health for me? I think it's easy getting lost in a city of thousands and thousands and thousands of people, you know, hustling and bustling. It's easy to get lost from what's truly important and what's real in this life. And when you kind of eliminate all those distractions and you're out in the mountains or you're out by a lake, or you're, you know, totally engaged and present in an activity, you're reminded of what's truly important, of what's truly real, that you're breathing and you're walking and you can see and you have a snack in your pocket and you can feel the wind in your face. And there are these like really small accomplishments that you're able to gain even outside when you summit a mountain, you make it to the top and you realize, wow, look at how far I've come. Look at this view. This is incredible. It's just such a joy. There's such a true presence in being outside and realizing how small you truly are and how insignificant some of these worries and fears, you know, feel in that moment.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a recharge. It's a recharge for me. And I've heard it, you know, from a lot of clients be a recharge for them, where it's the only time in their day or the only time in their week where they're really, really present and they really feel like, you know, they're able to appreciate.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I can relate to that. And the only caveat I always say to people is, like, when I was kind of really struggling with anxiety, when I was by myself in nature, that was like hell on earth for me. It was like a pressure cooker.
Oh, yeah.
But now that I have those skills and got it under control, so to speak, being in nature by myself, I love it. But so when I was in that place, being with others was absolutely fine because you can have those conversations and it somewhat keeps you distracted.
Right. You feel someone can protect you in case you need it.
Yeah, that's true.
When I was in high school,
go on.
I was just going to share, when I was in high school, I signed up for this wilderness program. It was sort of a joint. It wasn't a wilderness therapy program. Outward Bound. Hmm. It was called Spiritual Awakening or something like that. And part of the program was a solo night where I had to pitch a tarp and, you know, sleep outside by myself. Everyone's kind of scattered around this lake and, they were too far to hear. So you definitely felt alone. And I pitched my tarp on an angle. I don't know what I was thinking, but I didn't realize I'm from Florida originally. So everything's flat. So I didn't think about, you know, an angled, platform. So I pitched my tarp between these two bushes that looked pretty stable. And I got ready for bed and I got myself into my sleeping bag and it started to pour and I was getting soaked and I couldn't figure out why. And it was because I kept falling out from under the tarp. And so I think like being in that adverse environment, having to tolerate, you know, the cold and the wet and being alone and having no choice but to deal with it and accept it and try to get sleep and work through it. The next day we had the kind of a powwow and we really talked about our experiences. And to me, that felt like the most successful part of my trip was, you know, was being able to just deal with it.
Yeah.
And I survived it. Yeah.
Absolutely. It was just No, I love
funny
that.
Story.
And I bet you didn't make that mistake again.
No, I realized that mountains are on angles.
Yeah.
And they're not flat.
Fair point. Cool. So just a very general question now. It's just sort of words of hope for those with OCD.
Words of hope. If something's easy, then you probably aren't giving yourself the opportunity to grow and develop. Challenges breed insight and the opportunity to learn and allows you to become stronger. And failure is a wonderful thing to master, that the more you learn to successfully fail, then the more failure becomes a motivator. Hmm. So although it feels really scary for you to face those things that feel impossible and absolutely life-threatening and could jeopardize your moral character or mean something terrible about yourself, challenge it. Challenge those beliefs, because thoughts and feelings are not facts. They don't always clearly represent reality. And if you believe everything you think and you believe everything you feel, then you'll be missing out on a bigger life. So my words of hope is, it might get worse before it gets better, but it's likely to get better if you stick with it and you push through it. Hmm. And you're not alone, that there's a huge community out there of people who are in a very similar position as you are. Some people who have, you know, worked through it a little bit longer, some people who aren't ready to work through it the way that you have. But to reach out and to share your story, because you know, the more you keep it a secret, the more shameful it feels. And there's nothing shameful about you. Hmm. Everyone has unwanted, intrusive thoughts. They might not be as sticky in their mind, but everyone has a thought that makes them a little uncomfortable. Yeah. And you're not alone.
Absolutely. Yeah, great words. Thank you. So next question, if you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell her?
Oh man, I would tell her to go for it. I would tell her that every fear and worry that you have. I was just having this conversation with friends about how I wish I could redo like my early 20s as, you know, with the wisdom I have now. I would never say no. I would always just say yes and experience it, try things on, go for it. Because nothing is forever. Nothing is forever. Everything is constantly changing. And so, you know, that like at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about that West, you know, that mentality that we've learned early on is like everything matters. Find a path and make sure that you check everything off correctly and in a perfect way in order to achieve greatness. It's just not true. And so, you know, in your early 20s, you're transitioning and you're getting, you know, you're finishing college and you're looking for a job. And I would just tell my 20-year-old self, you know, don't take it so seriously, you know, make mistakes again and again and again, learn how to make those mistakes well, you know, say the things that scare you, try the things that make you a little nervous. Build those relationships that you feel like you are undeserving of. Just reach for it. Because the only thing stopping you is you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure many people in their 20s or looking back at their 20s can relate to that. I certainly can. Cool. So you've got a billboard in Denver. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Maybe, maybe not. I had a client knit me. It was so sweet. Just knit me a tiny little bookmark. And on it, it has this character with her, you know, that shrug, that famous shrug. And to the right, it says, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I'd say a lot of things, you know, the cliche, you know, like no one gets out alive. Life is too short.
Yeah.
You know, choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All good ones. Cool. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on today. And just, is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared?
Well, there's, I mean, I could talk about this for days and days and days. There's so much information to share. I think your questions were great. We covered a lot of ground. I think the biggest piece is just starting the conversation. You know, if you have OCD or you know someone with OCD or you think someone has OCD, talk about it. You know, talk about it. There's nothing that you can say that will force someone to do something that you don't want them to do. So if you're afraid of saying, you know, asking, do you have OCD? Are you triggered? You know, what's going on? It probably won't make the situation any worse than it already is. But if you have the courage and bravery to start that conversation, you know, and open up the dialogue, then it directly neutralizes the distress. So it becomes something that's less scary and something that's less taboo and you can't talk about it, more about something that is just an everyday thing. Yeah. You know, it's like if, you know, I went to the grocery store today, could be the same thing as, oh, I did ERP. It was great. I mean, it was hard, but it was really helpful.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people just, you know, they compartmentalize. They want their life to be separate from the condition, separate from the work. And that breeds shame, you know, the secrecy. And it doesn't have to be separate. There's nothing wrong with doing ERP. There's nothing wrong with having OCD. There's nothing wrong with you. Yeah.
No, I love that. And funny enough, it's what I was speaking about in my therapy session last week, or this week, Tuesday. And because I was saying, like, where I work, I was like, I didn't say, oh, I'm going to therapy tonight when they asked me, what are you doing? And I'm just like, oh, nothing, watching Netflix or something.
Right.
Not even that I'm doing a podcast on mental health. It's like, so the shame is even there for me. And you know, I kind of quite public about all of this.
Right.
So I get how hard it is, but I know that when I have kind of shared and opened up, the more I have, it's like switching that light on. It can't exist in the darkness. Sorry, it can only exist in the darkness. And when you switch that light on, So, but obviously there's a time and a place, and if it's right for you, it's right for you, and it should help, hopefully.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You choose the people you share that with.
Yeah.
But there will be at least one person in your life who is the right person to share that with.
Yeah. Good point.
And you can start there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. This was just such a pleasure, really an honor. Thank you so much for asking me to join you on the show.
So there you have it. Really hope you enjoyed my conversation with Karina. And all links and show notes will be on the website at theocdstories.com. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.